And we're finally back with a new episode of Gladio for Europe. I am your host, Liam, joined here by Russian Sam today. And first off, let me apologize for the little hiatus. I came down with a pretty annoying case of COVID, so I was out of commission for a while. But for the last few weeks, my co-host and I have been cooking up some really fun new Gladio content.
Oh yeah, we've been keeping busy, even if we haven't been delivering content to you.
Oh yeah, yes, we've got a lot of cool stuff coming up. First off, we're going to continue our focus on early 20th century and especially interwar politics, with a particular interest in North Africa. A lot of Americans know way too little about such an important world region, and we kind of touched on that with our Casablanca episode, but almost entirely due to the efforts of Russian Sam, we are going to go much deeper into both modern and medieval North Africa for the next few episodes and look at the ways that interactions between Europeans and North Africans throughout world history have had a really interesting impact on creating the world that we know today.
Oh yeah, I'd go so far as to say that North Africa is probably the most important region of the Mediterranean that no one really talks about much.
Totally, yeah, 100%. And, you know, entirely thanks to your efforts, Russian Sam, for the first time, Gladio for Europe is even going to be expanding outside the world of podcasting and embarking for the first time on, believe it or not, a physical media venture.
Yeah, so if you've been following us on Twitter, you've probably seen the cover that I made for a book that we're planning to republish. It's a novel called The Magnet by the author Ramon Sender, who is one of the most well-regarded Spanish authors of the 20th century.
Right, and that's why it's such a shock that this book is not currently in print in the United States in English. The rights had lapsed, and due to his amazing ingenuity, my co-host Russian Sam realized that we would be able to essentially republish the book ourselves and allow a much wider audience to access this really interesting work of literature.
Yeah, so just a little bit about the book itself. It's a semi-autobiographical novel that tells the story of a soldier serving in North Africa, Morocco specifically, in 1921 during the so-called disaster of Anwal.
Right. So this is, yeah, interwar years right up our wheelhouse.
It's not a feel-good novel. It's not something you would read at the beach per se, but I feel that it's an excellent book for understanding the way that Spanish imperialism in Morocco panned out in a way that I had to read several books to even get a glimpse of. This novel just gives it to you straight.
Right, right. I would say actually it is a beach read, but in exactly the same way that The Stranger is a beach read.
Yeah, so it's going to be out in a couple of weeks, hopefully. Stay tuned. And if this pans out well, we have more book content in the pipeline, hopefully.
Right. But for this week's episode, we are going to focus pretty heavily on North Africa, but North Africa about 1,000 years before The Magnet will be written. Because today, we are going to do the first of a two-part series on Sicily, this enigmatic island in the middle of the Mediterranean, right between Europe and North Africa, that would spend a really important chapter of its history under the control of Tunisian Muslims. In these two episodes, we're going to look at a much earlier encounter between North Africans and Europeans on the island of Sicily, between two groups that would originate thousands of miles away from each other, but would come together in this place at this time and create something pretty new and unique in the history of European, Mediterranean, Middle Eastern politics. This would be a shared culture that would exist on Sicily for hundreds of years between two successive groups of conquerors, the Arab Muslims from Tunisia and the Normans, a group of French-speaking Christians of Viking descent who would venture all the way to the Mediterranean at the start of the High Middle Ages. It's such a fun topic. We touched on it before in our last episode on the Normans, and it's an amazing link between Vikings and North Africa, two topics that we've spent a surprising amount of episodes on, having a lot of fun exploring. This is a really fun one. Sam and I really dove hard into the research. It's going to be kind of a long one. That's why we're splitting it up. But Sicily is a great place, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Sicily was the crossroads of many civilizations for a very long time. For as long as there's been written history in the Mediterranean, people have been fighting over Sicily. You had like a dozen Sicilian wars between various Greek colonists and Phoenicians, or rather the Punic Kingdom of Carthage. You had the Carthaginian Wars between Rome and Carthage. And you had so many different conflicts over this island because it's a very strategic location. It's smack dab in the middle of the Mediterranean. If you control it, you can control who has access to the eastern part of the Mediterranean rather easily. And so everyone was looking at this island with hungry eyes.
Right. Yeah. And the kind of funny little paradox with Sicily, as we looked at in our episode on the movie Golden Door, is that even though it was a crossroads of so many civilizations, it's deceptively parochial. It's a very large island, so a lot of people live quite far from the coast. And in modern times, Sicily is appears to be somewhat culturally homogeneous. But as we're going to talk about in these two episodes, its long history of international contact means that Sicily is still a really interesting cultural tapestry. You just have to look under the hood a little bit. And this episode, we're going to show you how the engine works. The engine of, you know, Sicilian history.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we can't go back right to the beginning because then you guys would never hear the end of it. But we're just going to...
Another episode on the Proto-Indo-Europeans. Yeah, we can't do that.
Yeah, so we're going to limit ourselves. We're going to start talking about the early Middle Ages.
Right. The fall of Rome, really.
Yeah, so as we mentioned, Sicily is right in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's really important if you want to control trade and access to the sea. So consequently, there was a lot of interest. You had the Byzantine Empire, or the Eastern Roman Empire, as they would have preferred to call themselves. You had various Sunni and Shia Arab caliphates based in Baghdad and Cairo and Damascus trying to make their mark on this place. And then later on, you had the empire of Charlemagne and the kingdoms of his descendants trying to put their fingers in that pie. But nobody really could have expected the Normans. I mean, if you had asked me about it, I certainly wouldn't expect a small group of descendants of Norsemen living in northern France to make their way into...
We should mention, these guys were not facing the Mediterranean the way that many people in France were. They were in the corner of France that was arguably farthest geographically from the Mediterranean, and I'd say maybe farthest culturally as well. Yet, somehow, it would be these guys, these French speakers, who would be the ones to pretty successfully rule the island for about 100 years. But so to take a step back, like we were saying, many, many nations had ruled Sicily in some part across antiquity in the Middle Ages. We're going to start with the fall of Rome. So let's talk about when Odoacer, this barbarian king, formerly a general under Roman service, proclaimed himself king of Italy and formally dissolved the Western Roman Empire, according to, you know, traditional historiography. Shortly after, Odoacer would be supplanted by the king Theodoric, one of his rivals. But at this point, Sicily was not in control of either of these barbarian kings. Instead, an entirely separate barbarian people, the Vandals, who were probably somehow related to the Goths, managed to first seize North Africa, which itself is pretty impressive, and then use North Africa as a staging ground to seize Sicily. Both of these factors here, you know, the fact that they're going from North Africa to Sicily, and the fact that they're basically, you know, barbarians of Northern European origin, are a funny taste of what's going to come later and what we're really going to focus on, you know. The Vandals wouldn't have much of a lasting impact, especially because in the 6th century, the famous Byzantine Empire Justinian would embark on a campaign to restore the western provinces, including Sicily and North Africa, which wouldn't do a great job at permanently reclaiming these territories for Rome, but would do a pretty good job at destroying whatever vestiges of Roman society still existed under barbarian rule, thanks to the unrelenting brutality of these invasions.
Yeah, it's quite ironic. Justinian, as many of you may know, was actually the last Roman emperor who spoke Latin as a native language.
Yeah, he's probably of Albanian origin, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and he Once he ascended to the throne, he decided that he wasn't content to simply rule from Constantinople. He decided that, you know, it's the Roman Empire. They should be in control of Rome. So he sent his general Belisarius on an expedition to recapture the Italian peninsula, which, of course, would have included Sicily in the program.
Right. So when the troops get to Italy, the king of the Ostrogoths, named Eraric, he's a descendant of Theodoric, who had, you know, replaced Odoacer. He initially saw the Romans coming and figured, okay, the jig is up. We've had our fun for a few decades. Now let's make some kind of peace to let these guys take back the peninsula. But before he could properly negotiate with Justinian, Eraric was actually captured and assassinated by a group of, I guess you'd say, you know, patriotic Ostrogothic noblemen who instead installed the general Totila as king. Totila was a pretty good military commander, and what he actually did was he led something of an early medieval guerrilla campaign against the Byzantines. And most important for our episode, Totila would seize Sicily, which had previously been held by the Vandals. There had been previous attempts by the Ostrogoths to take it, but from what I understand, it wasn't really until Totila that the Goths really bring back Sicily into the kind of broader Italian orbit.
Yeah, and the Byzantines just were not having it. They saw what was going on, and they sent their finest general, a eunuch by the name of Narses, to launch a scorched earth campaign against this guerrilla warfare that Totila and his men were waging on the island. So, if you know anything about counterinsurgency, you know that it's not exactly clean. It involves a lot of massacres. It's very brutal, but if it's done properly, it's very effective. So ultimately, Narses was successful, Totila was no more, and Italy was now once again under the thumb of the Romans. Except now, these Romans were, for the most part, speaking Greek.
Right, and that's pretty important for the history of Sicily.
So Justinian, he won his war, but it didn't come easily. There was a great cost. His campaigns had, first of all, totally ravaged the Italian peninsula, where previously Italy had been a very urbanized society. These wars of aggression to take the Italian peninsula turned the country into a field of ruins, frankly. Cities which had been prospering even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, well, if not prospering, at least keeping steady, this is when they were actually getting depopulated. The collapse of the Roman Empire, as we mentioned in the Crisis of the Third Century episode, did not bring with it the end of urban civilization. Rather, it created the power vacuum, which meant that it would be much more difficult for that urban civilization to continue existing.
Right. But now, with this massive invasion and devastating counterinsurgency tactics by figures like Belisarius and Narses, all the urban centers of Italy were heavily depopulated, and maybe most importantly, the Roman social institutions, which had existed for more than 1,000 years in a lot of cases, were gone. It was during the Gothic War that the Roman Senate seems to finally cease to exist. And, you know, if all of that social collapse wasn't bad enough, shortly after the war, probably not a coincidence, a major outbreak of plague occurs across the Mediterranean, most likely the same plague that would come back as the Black Death centuries later.
According to historian Cyril Mango, something like 25% of the population of the Mediterranean would have died in this period from warfare as well as famine and disease. And granted, they didn't have exactly the best methods of record keeping back in those days, but nevertheless, it would have been devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. Although we should mention, though, is that one place where this destruction seems to have been less extreme was Sicily. Sicily, which had been this early hotbed of resistance, was the first to be pacified by the Byzantines, which meant it was solidly in Greek hands for a long time. It was directly a crown property of the emperor, which was kind of unusual, so that direct influence culturally and economically and politically from Constantinople was very strong.
Yeah, as I was researching this episode, I found out that the second most important mint in the Eastern Roman Empire after Constantinople was located in Sicily.
Yeah. And so Sicily had been a very early Greek territory. It was Greek-speaking before the Romans got there. Now the Romans are back, except this time they're Greeks again, which is kind of funny. Justinian would die in 565, and the Lombards, who are probably the kind of most stereotypically barbarian of all the barbarian conquerors of this period would sweep into the ruins of Italy and pick up the pieces. Kind of ironically, they'd even kick out the Byzantines, thus reversing the gains that so many lives had been spent to win. But the Lombards wouldn't be able to get Sicily, which was too strongly fortified. Instead, the island, and in particular its capital Syracuse, became this really important stronghold of Byzantine power and Greek culture.
So this is still somewhat controversial among historians, but it would seem like Sicily itself didn't become Greek-speaking until the 7th century. Up until that point, it was speaking Romance dialect like the rest of the Italian peninsula.
Right. But what this does imply, which makes some Sicilian patriots a little upset to hear, is that the modern Sicilian language probably does not date back to the Roman era. It also means that the Greek that is spoken in parts of Italy, even to the present, isn't the Greek of Pericles, it's the Greek of Theodora. It's a medieval Byzantine Greek dialect, which is still super cool. And it's awesome that, at least in Calabria and Apulia, you can still hear some people speaking Greek, you know, after about 1500 years.
Yeah, but no offense to Sicily, but there is a lot more important stuff going on in this period aside from a dialect of Greek that's now spoken by a couple of thousand people. And that would be the rise of a little guy in a little land called Arabia by the name of Muhammad.
Yes, because during the chaos of the Byzantine Wars with both the Western barbarians and especially the Persian Empire, a new power would emerge in the East, the Arab Muslims of Muhammad. Under the Rashidun Caliphate established by his father-in-law Abu Bakr, the first Muslims would conquer a lot of Byzantine territory in Egypt and the Levant, and even seriously threaten the Byzantine heartland of Anatolia, which is Turkey today.
Yeah, and in fact, things got so bad that that while all of this was going on, there were serious fears that Anatolia itself and Constantinople might be taken, so the Byzantine court was actually evacuated onto Sicily. And they would stay there for a couple of years until the heat fell down and they were able to return to their beautiful walled city.
Right, but clearly they'd find out that nowhere was safe, because the Arab Muslims would not only attack by land, but also by sea. There was a really important Syrian governor and later caliph named Muawiyah, who would create the first Arab navy, which pretty successfully raided Byzantine islands like Cyprus and Crete, and also was able to capture remaining Levantine Byzantine port cities like Beirut and Tripoli. He's probably the reason that the English word admiral comes from Arabic.
Yep, it comes from the words Amir al-Bahr, which is like the prince of the seas.
Yeah. And Muawiyah absolutely was prince of the ocean, because he was able to launch naval blockades against Byzantine cities all across the Eastern Mediterranean. He was so effective that the Byzantines only were able to resist these blockades due to a pretty crazy new invention that I'm thinking a lot of our listeners have heard of.
Greek fire. It would have been something very similar to napalm. Unfortunately, the exact recipe has been lost to time. But for those who aren't in the know, basically the idea is that you light this substance on fire and it stays alight even on the water itself. You can't put it out with water. In fact, dousing it with water only makes it worse. And it's just not something you'd want on your wooden ship, frankly.
Yeah. So thanks to the invention of Greek fire, as well as some other pretty inventive naval defenses, like the famous chain that could cross the Bosporus Strait, the Byzantines were able to successfully resist the Arab conquest, although the Arabs would try three separate times to take Constantinople. But the existence of this hostile Islamic Arab caliphate right on the eastern flank would basically be a permanent existential threat to subsequent Byzantine emperors.
Yeah, and boy oh boy were the Arabs interested in Sicily. As we said, very strategic location, beautiful land, really important. So there were many attempts made to take Sicily. And in fact, in 740, they almost took Syracuse. They had the city under siege for a while, and it seemed like the city was about to fall, But then the Byzantines, they really lucked out in that in the year 740, you had the outbreak of the so-called Berber Revolt, which was complicated. But basically, it was the result of the Umayyads' racist tax structure, which basically meant that even if non-Arabs became Muslim, they still had to pay taxes as if they were non-Muslims. So because of this, the native population of North Africa rose up, they were unable to take Spain and Algeria and Tunis the way that they wanted to. But nevertheless, they were able to get their hands on Morocco as a nice consolation prize. And Sicily, under Byzantine rule, would live to see another day.
Right. Supposedly, according to the later Arab historian Ibn Khaldun, after this attempt failed, a bunch of Arab soldiers buried their swords in the desert and told their children, when it's time to take Sicily again, that's where the swords are. Great story. For the next 200 years, the Byzantines would be engaged in constant conflict with Arab forces in the Near East. Slowly, they'd manage to regain some of their holdings and increase their foothold in Italy. Although, as we'll talk about pretty soon, that foothold in Italy was always quite tenuous. On the other side of the empire, even more Western barbarians like the Bulgars, Khazars, and the Kievan Rus, who now are originating either in Central Asia or in Scandinavia, would be harassing their northern flank.
Yeah, and it was also during this time that the Franks, under our boy Charlemagne, who we discussed at length in episode 36, would conquer the Lombard kingdom up in Italy and bring that land into their orbit. So the Byzantine Empire would have to maintain its control over southern Italy, threatened both from the north by the Frankish invaders, as well as would-be Arab invaders from the south, who were only a short sailing trip away from their beautiful island of Sicily.
We should mention, Sicily and Tunisia are really, really close. If you look on a map, Tunisia is closer to Sicily than Rome is.
At the narrowest point, it's like 70 miles across the sea, I think, something like that.
Yeah, right. What's really the aberration of the Byzantine-Arab conflict, suddenly with Sicily in Christian hands and Tunisia in Muslim hands, this very short distance across the straits was basically severed. It was no longer safe for merchants to travel between these two territories despite the short distance, especially as raiders under Muawiyah and successors would be a constant threat to Christian sailors in the Mediterranean. Which this would lead to a pretty interesting kind of cultural shift, as Sicily would become increasingly Byzantine and Tunisia would lose most contact with formerly Christian lands.
Yeah, and this would continue for over a century, around 150 years, in fact, until finally in 826 you saw something change in a major way. You had an admiral named Euphemius of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantines, who was tasked with patrolling these waters around Sicily in search of Arab pirates who, you know how pirates are, they just like to capture ships and raid their stuff. And Euphemius, he was a strong guy. He had a lot of ambitions, and he seemed to run afoul of the governor of Sicily for whatever reason, and he even managed to get on the bad side of the emperor himself, Michael II.
Right. So Arab sources are pretty straightforward. They say that Euphemius violated imperial policy by attacking peaceful Arab trade ships without permission, but I'm more of a fan of the Sicilian version of the story, which is a lot more colorful. According to these records, Euphemius was engaged to a woman named Homoniza, who by all accounts is the most eligible bachelorette in the entire Byzantine Empire. Problem is, another local aristocrat also wants to marry her. This guy bribes the local governor of the island to block Homoniza's marriage to Euphemius, so she can marry him instead. Homoniza is horrified at this news, and instead of marrying this stranger, she decides to escape to a monastery and take on the vows of a nun. Euphemius, for his part, abducts slash rescues Homoniza, and the two are married in secret. So, you know, love prevails, but this is also a huge violation of her sacred oaths. As punishment for this, the governor of Sicily captures Euphemius, forcibly divorces him from Homoniza, strips him of his admiralty, and even cuts off his nose. A classic Byzantine trick. As a result of this barbaric mistreatment, Euphemius swears revenge against the governor, and maybe even against all of Christendom.
Yeah, and I'm sure the governor said, oh yeah, you and what army?
Right, and he would show them, because after declaring himself to be the true ruler of Sicily, Euphemius flees the island to the closest port, which is Tunis, held by the Islamic Aghlabid Emirate.
Yeah, so let's start looking into Tunisia, what was going on there at the time. During the first waves of wars between the Byzantines, the early Muslims, they would have been riding across the Mediterranean coast of North Africa and adding these provinces, which had previously been under the control of the Byzantines, into the Caliphate, severing the links that had existed with Italy and the rest of Christendom for over 100 years. So our boy Muawiyah, he ordered the construction of a new city in the area called Kairouan, which is actually comes from the same word as the word caravan. And as you might expect, at Kairouan, it was a really wealthy trade center, especially for cross-Saharan traffic in gold and, here we go again, slaves. It was basically very close to Sicily, as we mentioned previously, so it had many of the same advantages as Sicily itself would have, but as it would take a while for the Muslims to take Sicily, they had to make do with Kairouan for a while. But they did pretty well for themselves. It was a major, major center of Islamic learning. It has one of the largest mosques in Africa, like still to this day, I believe. And by Euphemius's time, its population was overwhelmingly Berber, or more properly called Amazigh. They actually don't really like to be called Berbers because it comes from the word barbarian. But yeah, anyway, so these indigenous North Africans, they are overwhelmingly Muslim by this point, and many of them spoke at least some Arabic as a second language, but there were really large differences in lifestyle and social status, which meant that there was a pretty big gulf between the natives and a much smaller class of Arab rulers, these militarized aristocrats whose ancestors had conquered the territory. Yeah, so our boy Muawiyah, he took it upon himself to make a new city in the region. This would become the city of Kairouan, which still exists to this day. It comes from the same word as the word caravan in English, and as you might expect, it was a major trade hub, especially for cross-Saharan traffic in gold, and here we go again, slaves. It was also a major center of Islamic learning, with one of the largest mosques at the time, and I believe still in North Africa. Yeah, it's not quite as good as Sicily, but nevertheless, it's a prime trading location, as the success of Kairouan showed. So yeah, by Euphemius's time, the population of Tunisia was still overwhelmingly Berber, or they prefer to be called the Amazigh, actually, the free people.
Right. Yeah, actually, yeah. As we talked about in our Casablanca episode, Berber comes from the same word as barbarian, so understandably, a lot of North Africans don't like to be called barbarians.
Yeah, so by this point, they were overwhelmingly Muslim, although usually not of the very orthodox variety, and many of them would have spoken at least some Arabic by this point, but there were still really massive differences in lifestyle and social status between these natives and a much, much smaller class of militarized Arab aristocrats who would have captured this territory from the Byzantines a century before. As I mentioned, there was the Berber Revolt of 740, which almost caused the Caliphate to lose control over North Africa, but they were able to reimpose their control over most of it.
So the Arabs here, they were pledged to the emirs of the Aghlabid dynasty, who we mentioned. The emirs were technically just governors who were theoretically appointed by the Abbasid Caliph in Baghdad, but in practice, they were basically hereditary monarchs who tend to pass the emirate from father to son, or perhaps more often, from brother to brother.
Yeah, and this is a development that you saw in the Caliphate at this time, where theoretically the Caliph still had the power over the land, but nevertheless, you had this outpouring of local dynasties everywhere. In Iran, for example, you had the Buyids. Here you had the Aghlabids. It was still on paper intact, but it was slowly dissolving.
Even in the Byzantines, as we'll talk about, a lot of times, when you look at a map of, you know, medieval Europe, it looks like you see the same colors. It looks like territorial possessions are very secure. In practice, these are really agreements that we're looking at. These, like, you know, systems of, you know, allegiances that they might look real on a map can easily dissolve with just, you know, a backroom deal.
Yeah, so as we mentioned, the core territory of the Aghlabid and Emirate was in what is now modern-day Tunisia, although they also had parts of what is today Libya, as well as the Algerian highlands.
Yeah, and so the people in these highlands, as well as peoples in the desert, you know, Saharan provinces, like we said, they were Amazigh or Berber nomads who usually didn't speak much Arabic. Yet at the same time, they were essential to the economic and military functions of the Aghlabid state. In addition to, you know, paying taxes and all that, their labor and their military service kept the wheels of this machine turning. Despite that essential role, tensions persisted between Berbers and Arabs. These were a constant facet of medieval North African history and are especially important to this episode. To take a little quick sidebar here, these kinds of tensions are usually described in ethnic terms, at least by European historians, but medieval Muslims didn't really have the same kind of understanding of ethnicity that modern Westerners do. There wasn't really a distinction made between Arab colonists from the Arabian Peninsula and Arabized people of Berber descent. They seem to have been sort of seen as the same group, especially because these Arabized Berber peoples often had some Arab ancestry and usually claimed descent from specific tribes mentioned in the Quran. What really matters here, the real important difference, in my opinion at least, is the lifestyle. We've talked about barbarians and nomads before, you know, in their contrast with city dwellers, and in North Africa in the Middle Ages, this is an incredibly sharp distinction. It's a pretty urbanized place. You've got all these cities like Kairouan, Algiers, Tunis, but most of the people are nomadic shepherds or semi-nomadic farmers, which leads to some pretty understandable conflicts, you know? The farmers and the city people want to use land for one purpose, and the shepherds want to use land for another purpose, which is, I would say, an irreconcilable difference, which often ends in violence, and very often this violence leads to nomadic peoples conquering an urban people and then themselves adopting the cultures of the city folk. This kind of socioeconomic difference is probably more important than any kind of ethnic or identitarian difference between Berbers and Arabs.
Yeah, although, as I mentioned previously, the Berber revolt was the result of explicitly racist policies by the Umayyad Caliph. So there was some grounding in ethnic difference, and I'm sure that it persisted. But nevertheless, for the most part, this, I would say, was overwhelmingly rooted in economics by this point.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we could say, regardless of why these tensions emerged, these kinds of tensions between nomads and city people, between Berbers and Arabs, would shape the rule of this one emir who is probably the most important for our episode. He is a man named Ziyadat Allah, and he would be the emir who would accept the Greek refugee Euphemios into his court. Ziyadat Allah was an Arab from a tribe that originated all the way out in the Persian Gulf, but interestingly, he didn't seem to have much loyalty to his fellow Arabic speakers. He was not as prejudiced to the Berbers as previous rulers of Tunisia had been. He also distrusted the Arabic-speaking aristocratic elite who formed the basis of his army as well as his own bodyguard.
Yeah, he came to power in the year 817 in the Gregorian calendar, about a decade before he would meet a Euphemius. And shortly after taking the throne, he decided that it would be unfeasible to rely on this tiny class of Arab noblemen to defend the country, which was overwhelmingly non-Arab. So he decided that he was going to strip these aristocrats of their power and replace them with the more professional and more ethnically mixed fighting force, which is a very common tactic in history. And I mean, it works to some extent, but ultimately you end up with the Mamluk situation. It's just very, very difficult to win in these kinds of scenarios.
But at the time, though, his problem isn't that his new armies get too powerful. It's that his old armies aren't going to be disbanded without a fight. A treacherous general named Mansur, instead of disbanding his troops as he is supposed to, instead leads them in a revolt against the emir. And to make matters worse, disgruntled Berbers, who are still, you know, sore from the mistreatment in the century prior, decide to join this revolt. And so as soon as Ziyadat Allah takes the throne, he has a two-sided invasion, essentially, by one group of, you know, rebellious Arabs and one group of rebellious Berber nomads. Together, this mixed Arab-Berber force, which is kind of ironically what Ziyadat Allah had hoped to create, is now fighting him. They quickly take over Tunis, and they even send him fleeing out of the capital of Kairouan. So the emir and his family have to flee the court under the cover of darkness, and the rebels were able to take the city without a fight.
Under normal circumstances, this seemed like it would have spelled the end of the dynasty. But Teodatala, he was a really clever man to now found that he was a fugitive in his own country. Mansur would learn that this young emir, he was a really stubborn guy and that he wouldn't just roll over and let himself be overthrown. So he wouldn't abandon his hopes of creating this new military force. And he was able to draw on subjects of the emirate, even really distant tribesmen who weren't up in revolt, who probably, you know, had some beefs with these guys, that guys. He was probably able to appeal to their feelings in that regard.
So while hiding away with some relatives, Ziyadatala manages to smuggle a message out to the distant Nafwazi Berbers of the edge of the Sahara, who are probably the most remote subjects of the emirate.
So the Nafwazi nomads at this point, they are Ibadis, which is a small splinter sect of Shia Islam, which is typically distrusted by the Sunnis of North Africa. But at this point, it still wasn't quite as fringe because of the Berbers' troubles with the Arab conquerors. They were, in fact, very open to all of these sects, which the Arabs looked down upon as extremist in their language. But because Ziyadatala was now an outcast in his own country, he realized that his best option was to ally with these other people who are on the periphery, who are also treated as outcasts. We don't really know how he did this, but he manages to convince these people that they're going to fight on his side to help bring him back to the throne. So the Nafwazis, they thunder out of the desert, mounted on their camels and horses, and the evicted emir joins them with his small core of supporters, which had been following him ride or die all the way through this. And this new alliance of Arabs and Berbers manages to take back the city of Kairouan and Tunis writ large from this rival alliance. Ziyadatala is restored to his place as emir. He offers clemency to the Arab troops who surrender, but many of Mansur's other soldiers flee into the desert, never to be seen again. They no longer pose an immediate threat to his rule, but Ziyadatala decides that he's going to spend the next 10 years dealing with these guerrillas and bandits who had been part of this failed attempt to overthrow him. But at the back of his mind, he's constantly worried about the fact that someday the followers of Mansur would once again ally with nomadic tribes and take over Tunisia. He needed to find something to do with them. So in the year 827, when the ambitious Byzantine admiral named Euphemius comes to the court pleading for help, Ziyadatala has a really brilliant idea.
He tells Euphemius that he will invade Byzantine Sicily on his behalf, and he'll even promote him as ruler of the island in exchange for an annual tribute payment. Islamic scholars were excited about this on religious grounds because, you know, they'd previously tried and failed to take this island a century before. This kind of conquest could bring glory to Islam and make a new name for the Aghlabid dynasty. But what I think really motivated the new emir is that Sicily is a large island that's separated from Tunisia by the sea. If it were to come under Aghlabid rule, a whole bunch of soldiers would be needed to maintain it. These soldiers wouldn't always be able to easily return to the African mainland. It would be a way to keep these troops busy and safely distant from the capital.
Yeah, this is a really smart tactic. It's been used effectively throughout history. For example, in Japan at the end of the 16th century, the general Toyotomi Hideyoshi decides he's going to invade Korea and attempt to capture China itself because he has all of these samurai who are from rival factions who suddenly find that they don't necessarily like the fact that there is now a new shogunate in town, but if they go abroad, they're going to be Japanese, not rival claimants to their own imperial lines. So consequently, they launch this invasion, and it's a crazy story. We'll get to it someday, but let's get back to Sicily.
for sure. Yeah. So meanwhile, another invasion is being launched, not in Korea, but here in Sicily, where Ziyadatala convinces many of his formerly rebellious Arab troops to join with his new, primarily Berber army to jointly invade Sicily. According to Ibn Khaldun, there was a 10,000-man troop on 100 ships, which I think seems a little bit exaggerated, but it was definitely a formidable force. And this force was so formidable that after a few early successes against the Byzantine defenders, Euphemius, who's supposed to be the leader of this whole mission, starts to wonder if maybe these Muslim allies can't really be trusted to appoint him as leader, like they said. After he hears one of the officers make a disparaging comment about Greeks like him, Euphemius chooses to betray the Muslims that he earlier defected to, which I think is a classic case of, if he will cheat on her, he will cheat on you.
Yeah, so during the siege of the town of Enna, the locals send word to Euphemius that they're ready to shelter him and to support his claim to leadership over Sicily once the Muslim invaders were dealt with. So Euphemius, he sneaks out of the Arab camp and he gets himself into the city. But rather than proclaim himself as the leader, he's, captured and executed on the spot for bringing this invasion onto the island in the first place. So
yeah, which I think just kind of goes to show that if you double cross somebody and then you try to triple cross them, you might just get quadruple crossed yourself. Sorry, Euphemius. R.I.P. Bozo.
Yeah, unfortunately, he wasn't playing 6D chess.
Right. But he was now safely out of the way, which meant that the Muslims, under Ziyad Allah, could much more easily claim Sicily as their own. There was no longer a pretense of restoring it to the rule of some Christian ruler. It could now rightfully become, in their mind, an Islamic possession. So over the course of the 9th century, the Arabs would slowly conquer the rest of the island, eventually claiming the one-time Byzantine capital of Syracuse, turning Syracuse as well as the port Palermo into the twin jewels of the crown of Islamic Sicily. Ziyad Allah is going to enter the annals of Islamic history as one of the few leaders who brought the Roman Empire to its knees and could conquer a province that even the caliphs could not.
Yeah, we're not sure if Ziyad Allah ever got to see his new possession himself, but the conquest would prove really successful. It would totally transform the fortunes of the Aghlabid Emirate, which had at this point been this sort of rinky-dink young dynasty. It sort of rocketed them upwards in terms of power, and they became one of the most important dynasties of medieval Islamic history, leaving a huge mark on the memories of the people of modern Tunisia.
Yeah. So a lot of the Arabic-speaking nobles, probably including the ones who had previously rebelled against him under Mansur, sailed to Sicily to seek their fortunes as local landowners in this new country. They'd become basically feudal overlords of Greek-speaking farmers, although some of them would also make extra money as pirates. Just like Euphemius had allegedly done, capturing now Christian trade vessels and bringing the treasures back home, either to Sicily or Tunisia. It seems like the new conquerors were never anywhere close to a majority, but they were still a pretty big chunk of the population. And over time, this Arabic-speaking elite would start to shape the Greek-speaking society of Sicily, but in turn, themselves adopt many aspects of their Greek subjects. And I think this brings us to a really important aspect, not only of Islamic Sicily, but also for this broader Arab-Norman Sicilian civilization, which was the fact that although many different peoples from different areas would come in, there would be a constant cultural interchange that seems to be a bit more peaceful than you see in other parts of Europe at the time. We're going to talk in the next episode about how you really don't want to valorize medieval history too much, because this still would have been an unbelievably violent and intolerant place by modern standards. But relatively, Sicily in both the Muslim and the Norman periods seems to have been a pretty good place to be a cultural or religious minority.
Yeah, so Muslim rulers really didn't make much of an effort to change the culture or religion of their Greek Christian subjects. Instead, they adopted many of the accoutrements of Sicilian society, and particularly the patronage of secular Greek art and craftsmanship. But again, this shouldn't necessarily be taken as a sign of tolerance. We'll get into that later. But despite the fact that these Greek Christian traditions were so strong, Sicily was pretty fully incorporated into the Islamic world at this point, thanks to the strength of the court and the output of the Sicilian Muslim scholars. Sicily was part of Arab Muslim civilization as much as Baghdad, even if most of the population remained Christian. And in addition to the Christians, you had the Jews of Sicily who also experienced relative tolerance compared to what they would have faced in Christian Europe, which you also saw in Islamic Spain. And again, this is all being spoken of in terms of contemporary standards. In reality, like A big part of the reason why these rulers weren't so keen on converting their subjects was because non-Muslims actually paid more in taxes. So it made a lot of sense for these early states to not really try to convert them because, I mean, if you keep them Christian or Jewish, then, you know, you have more money to play around with for your wars or your patronage. And Maimonides, who's one of the most famous Jewish scholars, he lived in Egypt around this time. He wrote in Arabic. He wrote The Guide to the Perplexed, in which he includes correspondences in Arabic, again, with the rabbis who at that point were living in Sicily.
Yeah, although we should actually mention that it seems like most of the rabbis were probably native Greek speakers. So this kind of indicates that, you know, this is the kind of society where many people are learning multiple languages. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the Arabs who moved to Sicily also picked up some Greek themselves. This is what we see in the later Norman period. Eventually, you know, sorry to spoil this, the Normans will come to Sicily. Many of them, including the dukes, become both Greek and Arabic speakers. Speaking of Greek, it seems like the Jewish community of Sicily actually kept on to the Greek language longer than the Christians. Tragically, in 1493, once Sicily became a Spanish province, they would be expelled just like all Jews from the Spanish Empire. But it seems like at the time of their expulsion, they were still Greek speakers, even though Sicilian Christians were not. During the Arab era, it doesn't seem like the biggest change was cultural. Instead, there was a profound economic and technological transformation of the island.
The ancient links which existed between Sicily and the Near East had been severed in the Middle Ages by the Islamic conquest of the Levant and Egypt, and then the constant threat of piracy and raids by the Arab leaders like Muawiyah and his successors. But now that Sicily was again in the fold of the same empire which controlled these regions, the sea routes, they came back, which allowed goods and technologies to flow much more freely than before between Sicily and the other ports of the Islamic world. And because of this, because of Sicily's proximity to the Catholic world, in fact, Sicily was able to become sort of a link connecting the Catholic world to the Islamic world, which allowed contacts and diplomacy to happen on the island.
Yeah, maybe just because of its, you know, central geographic location that we've talked about so many times today. It was able to be this kind of peaceful cultural hub, for the most part, that you didn't really see in other frontier areas. At least not to the same extent.
Yeah, so some of the innovations that would have been introduced at this time were agricultural in nature. The Islamic world was really having a heyday in terms of agriculture at this time, and their techniques really worked wonders for a dry climate like Sicily. The Aghlabids, they invested a lot of money into new techniques that made olive oil production especially profitable. And it was during the Emirate of Sicily that Middle Eastern crops like oranges, lemons, and sugarcane became a large part of the Sicilian economy. And in addition, the Arabs actually reintroduced rice to Italy, which was the first time that the crop had been cultivated on the island since the Roman era, from where it would spread up the rest of the Italian peninsula through the High Middle Ages.
Yeah, so hey, if you like arancini, you know, thank an Arab.
Yeah, and this Sicilian rice would end up becoming a huge part of the economy of the Western Italian coast as well, because, I mean, shout out to rice. Rice is beautiful.
Yeah. Staying on the subject of carbs, probably the clearest influence in North Africa is how Sicilians and Sardinians have their own version of couscous. It's called fregula, which I kind of want to try. I think it's like couscous but toasted, little pasta balls. Sounds good.
Yeah, and they usually serve it with tomato sauce, I believe.
Ooh, that sounds awesome. Yeah, yeah. In any case, thanks to these agricultural innovations, cities in Sicily would start really prospering in ways that you didn't seem to see as much in the Byzantine period. This was in part thanks to natural population growth from this, you know, new agricultural output, as well as the fact that there was a lot of migration coming from North Africa. Palermo probably had at least 100,000 people, which would have made it briefly one of the largest cities in Europe. I'm a little skeptical if these numbers are accurate, but some Islamic writers at the time believed that the cities had something like 700 mosques, and that most of the population, at least of the urban dwellers, would have been Muslims.
Maybe in the cities. Yeah, but What's really important to mention is that Adiaghlabids didn't just take over Sicily in one night. It didn't happen all at once. It was really difficult to transfer Berber cavalry from North Africa across the Mediterranean.
Yeah, God, can you imagine putting a camel on a boat?
And you really don't want to be around a pissed off camel. But anyway, because of this, most of the wars in Sicily had to be fought by these local Arab landowners who, again, had been sent to the island with the expectation that rather than being rebellious noblemen at home, they would now be Arab conquerors in a foreign land. So these people, they would have their own small retinues of other Arabs, and they probably would have hired mercenaries as well. Many of them probably would have been Greek speakers, because for most ordinary people on the ground, religion was secondary to money. Yeah, because of the fragmented nature of the situation, you had a lot of Greek Christian towns which remained formally independent all the way until the beginning of the 10th century, which was when the final pockets of resistance finally gave way to the Aghlabids. And yeah, so they, the Aghlabids now control the entirety of the island of Sicily. So did they just decide that they've had enough and they're going to rule what they have and consolidate the rule? Or did they have some bigger ambitions in mind?
No, indeed. In fact, actually, even before they had fully secured control over Sicily, many of these new Sicilian Muslim aristocrats began to set their sights on other Mediterranean islands and even the Italian mainland, although this would end up becoming a classic case of biting off more than you can chew. These aristocrats, who usually came from humble backgrounds, many of them had been were like the grandsons of Berber tribesmen who were now Arabic-speaking nobles, they started going abroad, partially because, due to this lingering kind of class resentment, they knew that they could never be fully respected back home in Tunisia or even in Sicily. They needed to go farther out. So a lot of Arab Muslims based in Sicily started carving out small territories on the Italian mainland, at the bottom of the boot. They took advantage of the fragmentary politics of southern Italy, which at the time was mostly nominally part of the Byzantine Empire, and would often make alliances with one Christian ruler to team up against another Christian ruler. Certainly the most important of all of these small Muslim territories was the Emirate of Bari, which was established all the way back in 847, less than 20 years after the conquest of Sicily. Arab sources indicate that it was actually not nobles who established this, but instead a group of recently converted former slaves, most likely from sub-Saharan Africa, who managed to seize the city of Bari, which was technically, like we said, a Byzantine vassal up until this point.
Yeah, and because of their social origins, the emirs of Bari never really earned the respect of the far more powerful Amaghlabids, even though they were co-religionists. Again, religion isn't everything. But during this time, when they were setting themselves up in Bari and other cities, you also had similar groups of Muslim pirates who might have also been commoners and former slaves, taking advantage of the middle of the 9th century to capture Italian trade vessels and to plunder the port cities of Italy, including the suburbs of Rome itself, rather famously enough.
Right, yeah. And so while the Aghlabid aristocrats in Tunis might have initially cheered on these raids by their fellow Muslims, it turned out that threatening Rome, and therefore threatening the Pope, would be a bridge too far. Because as soon as the papacy comes under threat of these Arab brigands, Pope Leo IV appeals to the Byzantines for help. This was before the Byzantines and the Catholics had fully split. There were still a lot of tensions, but regardless, it was a big deal that the Byzantines said yes. They would intervene and defend their Western cousins. So the Byzantines, who were still very sore over the loss of Sicily, they take a break from their own constant religious squabbling to send a massive fleet to the Tyrrhenian Sea to meet the raiders outside the port of Ostia next to Rome. Papal and Byzantine forces crush these pirates, sending hundreds of them washing ashore on the Italian mainland. These prisoners would be taken as the personal slaves of Pope Leo. I think Leo is clearly one of the most vindictive popes in history because he'd used these large numbers of new slaves to build the Leonine city, a district of Rome that would remain in papal hands for the next 1,200 years. Can you guess, Sam, what we call the Leonine city today?
I'm going to guess that it's the Vatican today.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. So again, in a roundabout way, thank an Arab. This Christian counteroffensive would put Muslims in Italy on the back foot, which would lead to territories like the Emirate of Bari eventually being conquered, which we'll talk about in a second. Also, you had ports in Sardinia and Corsica that would be abandoned at this time. Because just like with the advent of Greek fire centuries before, these Muslim pirates no longer had command of the Mediterranean. So, Sam, can you tell us about what's going on with the Franks at this time? Because as we mentioned before, the descendants of Charlemagne were also important players in the Mediterranean. Tell us about Louis II.
So despite the fact that the Franks are way up in the north, Frankish soldiers would actually play a very important role in this conflict. They would fight most of the battles, in fact. And at this point, their king was a young Frankish nobleman named Louis II, who was the great-grandson of Charlemagne. Louis II, he had a lot of fun harassing the Muslims of mainland Italy, particularly the Emirate of Bari, which had existed for nearly the entirety of his adult life. King Louis, he really spent those 19 years trying and failing to take the city through various sieges and assaults. It has an almost Don Quixote quality to it.
Yeah. Or if you want to be a little more lowbrow, it's like, Charlie Brown in the football. He kept almost getting it, but, you know, those wily guys in Bari, those Muslims would always find a way to hold out, especially because Bari is right at the bottom of the boot of Italy, really far away from the Frankish power center, which was northern Italy. Louis had to rely on a constantly changing and constantly unreliable set of southern Italian Christian allies who, like we mentioned, were almost all nominally allied to the Byzantines. Eventually, this got so dire that he even had to call in support from some Slavic chieftains in Croatia who had very recently become Christian, but ended up being, you know, pretty eager to help out in this fight to prove their Catholic fervor.
Yeah, in fact, Liam, thank you for taking this up. The historian Steve Fanning says that an attempted alliance with the Byzantines fell apart in 869 because Louis insisted on styling himself as the Emperor of the Romans. This naturally did not play well because the Romans were like, hey, wait a minute, that's us. And naturally, it was very difficult to find a compromise in the situation, so none was found. They called off the planned invasion of Bari, which would live to see another day.
That's great. Yeah. Eventually, in 871, Louis would manage to pull off this invasion because he'd call in the support of another important but dangerously unreliable ally, who is Duke Adelchis of Benevento. The Beneventans were the only Christian rulers in southern Italy not to be in any way connected to the Byzantines, and there's a reason for that, because if the name Adelchis doesn't sound very Greek or Italian, that's because the Beneventans were the last descendants of the Lombards. They were, in a sense, a Lombard rump state that had ruled for centuries after the, you know, Franks had, and the Byzantines had already run through Italy, this kind of last gasp of the barbarians who came in after the Wars of Justinian.
Yeah, and in fact, the Muslims would team up with some of the other local kingdoms to invade these guys because, again, they're not under the protection of Byzantium, so it's free real estate as far as everyone's concerned.
Right, yeah. The fact that they had ruled so much of Italy for so long meant that the remaining Lombards in Benevento sort of had a chip on their shoulder, and they resented both the Carolingian and the Byzantine emperors. So when the Frankish King Louis, who's, like we said, a great grandson of Charlemagne, when he wants Beneventan help, Adelchis says yes, but he actually has other plans. The Beneventans would help Louis invade and destroy the Emirate of Bari. But during the chaos of the battle, it would be Beneventan soldiers under Adelchis, and not the Franks under Louis, who would capture the last emir, who is a guy named Sadon. According to a poem commissioned by Louis' court, which tragically has not been translated to English, so I'm just going off of an offhand citation in a text, it seems like the Emir Sadon was not treated as a prisoner of Duke Adelchis, but instead an honored guest, and that in the 6 months after Louis captured the city of Bari, Sadon had become really good friends with Adelchis. And Sadon would convince Adelchis to betray Louis and allow him to regain his throne as Emir of Bari.
That's a really funny name. Do you know what his name literally means, Liam?
No, I don't. I wish I don't speak any Arabic. What does it mean?
It literally means, like, black eye.
No way. You know, I'm realizing now that might be why historians assume that they were from Inner Africa, the dynasty that conquered. That's really interesting. Well, in any case, you know, he and this guy of distant Northern European origin, you know, despite their, you know, very different backgrounds, they became friends, according to later sources, and they conspired to betray Louis. So Adalchis invites Louis to a banquet in 871, but uses this as a pretense to take the royal family hostage. You know, classic story. After a month of imprisonment in Benevento, which is apparently a much more austere imprisonment than what Sadon was subject to, Louis was released on the condition that he would give up his territories in southern Italy and abandon any imperial ambitions in that part of the country. So obviously, you know, we can take this poem with a big grain of salt, but what this does indicate is that divisions among Christians were very severe in Italy. These divisions were so severe that alliances or conspiracies with neighboring Muslims didn't seem out of the question.
And almost immediately after the release of Louis, before the city of Betty could change hands, the Beneventans found that they have a new challenger, a much more powerful one. That would be the Aghlabid Emir himself, who decided that now was the time to invade southern Italy.
Right. And so this was a good 50 years since the first invasion started of Sicily. So this was a big deal. I think that no one really saw this coming, especially because 20 years before this, there was a resounding defeat of Muslims at the Battle of Ostia. So the Christians thought they were safe. Clearly not.
Previously, the Aghlabids had no success in amassing the numbers of forces that would be necessary to make this happen. But now they had a new emir, Muhammad, who had recently captured the island of Malta, just to the south of Sicily, decided that one last attempt needed to be made to cement Muslim rule in mainland Italy. So they got a Sicilian Muslim army together, and they invaded the land of Southern Boots. Whereas last time, these were disorganized bands of pirates and commoners looking to make a name for themselves. Now the people of southern Italy were faced with a professional army which began besieging all of their major cities. Attempts by Benevento and the neighboring Salerno to repel the invasion was a miserable failure.
Right, and so with no other option, Duke Adalchis had to do the unthinkable. He had to call in help from King Louis, who he had just tricked, imprisoned, and extorted.
Oh man, I hate when I get triple-crossed.
So Louis, who by now is back home in northern Italy, initially Louis didn't want to lift a finger at all to help these treacherous Lombards. But then he realized something. If they needed him, then he might not actually have to give up the territories in Bari like he'd promised to. However, he'd have no hope of holding on to these territories if this Muslim army was ravaging across the south of Italy. So what he decided was that he had to return to Italy himself, just 6 months after he'd been imprisoned in that same part of the country, and he adopted a new, pretty interesting strategy that would eventually successfully unseat these Muslim armies besieging the Italian cities.
Yeah, it almost has a slapstick quality to it. Most famously, this tactic was depicted in Macbeth, by Shakespeare, but basically what Louis did was he ordered his troops to walk around carrying all of these really leafy branches to serve as camouflage so that they could disguise themselves as the forest. And for whatever reason, the defenders didn't seem to notice that the forests were getting closer to the gates of the city. But by the time they finally realized that, hey, wait a minute, that's not a forest, it was too late.
It didn't just work once, it worked like five times, and that he successfully used this tactic to relieve the sieges of like every city in southern Italy. Capua, Bari, all of them.
I mean, listen, if you don't catch on after the first time, you deserve it.
Writers at the time, they insisted that this whole series of events was actually God's will. Because Benevento had betrayed the Frankish King Louis, who himself, we should add, was anointed by the Pope, they would now suffer a divine punishment. Because Louis had so graciously intervened to save the people who had betrayed him, he would get a divine reward, which was Louis was now the unquestioned ruler of southern Italy. This is kind of important because now you have a French-speaking elite in the south of Italy. We're going to expand on this next episode, but this is important here. It's a link that's going to stay here. Although this long-term French-speaking link is going to stay, Louis himself would only briefly be able to enjoy his new and somewhat unexpected territorial control of basically all of southern Italy. Because right after this war, he'd go to Rome, formally be crowned emperor by the Pope, but would almost immediately after die in his bed. And as would so often happen in medieval history, this one king's influence would not survive him, because after Louis's death, Duke Adalchis, who had been now reduced to a Frankish vassal, was offered a better deal by the Byzantines. And slowly, all of the Christian nobles of southern Italy flipped back to the Byzantines, who would once again control the bottom of the boot for about 100 years.
You know, all this flip-flopping back and forth, I think I finally understand Italians.
So Louis II's dominion over southern Italy was not going to survive him, but this victory would have an irreversible impact on the Aghlabid Emirate, because they would realize that it would never be effective to attempt to retake southern Italy. Because southern Italy was connected to the mainland of Europe, they would always be at risk of some kind of invasion from anywhere on the continent, which they wouldn't be able to resist.
This isn't Europa Universalis. You can't just punch in the cheat code and get infinite manpower. At a certain point, you're going to run out of soldiers, and that's exactly what happened. So many troops were lost in Benevento and Capua and Salerno that the once mighty Maghrebid Emirate no longer had the ability to project power outside of Sicily and Tunisia. So the coastal forts in Sardinia and Corsica had to be abandoned. The ambitious Emir Muhammad, whom we mentioned previously, would die during an outbreak of the plague in the year 875, very soon after the death of the Frankish king Louis, who had humiliated him. This was the end of an era, the beginning of a new one, and this now permanently weakened Aghlabid state would fall into the hands of his brother Amr Ibrahim, who was probably the most interesting ruler of the Emirate, if I want to use the most neutral wording possible.
So we should add here that I don't think anybody in the West knows who Ibrahim was unless you specifically study Islamic history, but he's a pretty important part of the modern folklore of North Africa, especially because Ibn Khaldun, who we're citing a lot in this episode, meticulously recorded his rule, especially the supposedly unbelievably inhumane cruelties that he would wreak upon his population. So Ibrahim takes the throne, and in an event straight out of Crusader Kings, a bunch of disloyal nobles and vassal tribes immediately try to take advantage of his inexperience by launching multiple revolts against him. However, although Ibrahim was less ambitious than his brother in terms of military conquest, he ended up being a lot more effective at actually winning wars, because he was able to defeat all of these rebels quite easily, sending them fleeing to the desert, or importantly, as we'll talk about in a minute, to the green hills of northern Algeria. But for now, Ibrahim secures his rule, and he's able to reform his professional Arab troops, just like his predecessor Ziyadat Allah had done, get rid of these potentially disloyal professional Arab soldiers, and create something new.
Yeah, but whereas Ziyadat Allah had Sicily to send these guys to, Ibrahim had to be more creative and much more cruel, more stick than carrot. He ordered the mass arrest and execution of suspected disloyal troops in his palace guard, and he replaced them with thousands of slave soldiers imported from sub-Saharan Africa as well as Eastern Europe. And with this new enormous army of recent converts and slaves, Ibrahim was no longer dependent on these Arab-speaking professionals or the nomadic Berber tribes who made up the majority of the population of Tunisia and who had bailed out Ziyadat Allah.
Right. And also, importantly, Ibrahim was the first emir to recognize the limitations of Aghlabid military power. Instead, he focused on developing the core territories of Tunisia and now Sicily instead of trying to conquer more lands abroad. One of his big lasting transformations was that, to avoid the constant intrigue of the capital Kairouan, Ibrahim built a new capital called Rakada, which is Arabic for the sleepy place. Cute name, right? Because the plague that had killed Ibrahim's brother also depopulated much of the countryside, Ibrahim invested in labor-saving techniques like mass irrigation, which would produce a lot more food with fewer farmhands. A lot of the canals and drainage ponds that were built by Ibrahim's workers are actually still there in Tunisia today. So if you ever want to, you know, take a Mediterranean vacation, you'll probably see like a little historical plaque in Arabic explaining that the infamous Emir Ibrahim built this.
Were these the canals?
Yes, they were. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, for our listeners, canals are basically underground aqueducts. Great technology.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah, actually very, very, very sophisticated. Yeah. And again, this is the kind of thing that they were bringing to Sicily. The Byzantines, they were very sophisticated in a lot of ways, but they weren't as good at dry agriculture, which is so important if you're trying to have an agricultural society in a very arid climate. Due to this newfound prosperity, Ibrahim minted a huge number of gold coins, which were circulated really widely. Interestingly, we've even found some of these coins from his reign at Viking sites in England and Scandinavia. I think, put a little note here, we're going to want to keep an eye on those guys, the Vikings. They're going to come, they're going to be important.
Yeah, whenever you're talking about this period, you can't not talk about the Vikings.
Exactly, especially even somewhere as far away as Sicily, right. Probably the most impressive of all of Ibrahim's achievements was that he supposedly built a system of stone signal towers, just like in Lord of the Rings. You light one torch, they see a mile away, they can light another one, you know? And according to Ibn Khaldun, this system was so effective that if there was some kind of crisis in Morocco, people could learn what was happening in Alexandria before the end of the night. You know, I'm not so sure if that's true. That seems like kind of an exaggeration. But many of these signal towers are still standing today across Algeria and Tunisia. And I think in a way you can kind of compare it to the legacy of the bunkers by Enver Hoxha in Albania, you know, except these are 1,000 years old.
Yeah, well, we'll see which ones outlast. Yes, according to the Arab sources of the period, again, we're primarily relying on Ibn Khaldun for this period. Sicily and Tunisia at this time would reach the heights of their prosperity. They would become some of the most coveted lands in the Islamic world. So far, everything we've told you about this Ibrahim guy sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah, I want an Ibrahim ruling me.
Well, here's the but. Unfortunately, Ibrahim, he was very effective, but he also had his own pet issues that he was very passionate about, let's say. So even by the standards of the time, he was incredibly, incredibly homophobic. He decided that he was going to order the execution of anybody accused of sodomy in his kingdom, and he allegedly killed one of his own bodyguards when he caught him with a dalliance with another man.
Right, and just to clarify, I don't just mean he had him executed. He personally murdered him, supposedly by throwing his body into a fire pit in the palace.
And all this is quite interesting because, I mean, in theory, in Islamic law, homosexual sex does carry the death penalty, but there is the caveat that you also need to have several witnesses present to describe what exactly was going on. So it wasn't really applied that often.
Yeah, yeah. Ibrahim was not really a we need witnesses kind of guy. I think he kind of, you know, if he had a hunch, he was going to kill you.
Yeah, but he had very particular tastes, and he did not like it when things didn't go his way. He, at one point, ordered the execution of 300 of his palace servants because one of them had placed a napkin in an incorrect part of the table.
Methinks the emir perhaps protests too much, if that's the kind of thing that sets him off. Like many Islamic monarchs, Ibrahim was a polygamist, although, interestingly, there was a law in the emirate, which I think was kind of unique in the Islamic world, which said that nobody except the emir could have multiple wives, which also, you know, led to resentment among the nobility. He had a large number of wives and children, but he had, perhaps unsurprisingly, multiple of his wives executed for suspected disloyalty or treachery.
Ibn Khaldun, writing about this period, insists that he was particularly misogynistic, even by the standards of the time, and he basically ordered that all of his daughters be killed at birth, which, in a scenario straight out of Greek myth, as it turned out, his servants weren't too keen on killing these infant girls, so they would just smuggle them into the countryside to be raised by commoners. But after a while, Ibrahim learned what was going on. He sent his soldiers to track down each of these daughters and ordered them to return with their heads.
Right. And even his own firstborn son would not be spared this cruelty. Because when Ibrahim believed that his son might one day grow up to overthrow him, he ordered his own son, his firstborn son, to be executed. So perhaps unsurprisingly, multiple Western historians have compared Ibrahim to Russia's Ivan the Terrible, even though Ibrahim predates him by about 600 years.
crazy people with immense amounts of power tend to look the same throughout history, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? But here's the craziest thing about all of this. All of that we talked about, that's not even what makes Ibrahim so infamous. Because he would commit even more acts of cruelty that would permanently cement his reputation as one of the most villainous figures in Islamic folklore, which was that in the 9th century, he decided to deal with those professional Arab troops for good. A group of aristocratic Arab officers, understandably frustrated at their replacement by foreign slaves, demands an audience with Ibrahim. He tells them, you know what? I'll hear your case. I'm going to invite you to my beautiful palace in Rakada, the sleepy place, and you can have a giant overnight banquet. So he brings all this food in, he plies them with alcohol. Eventually, hundreds of aristocrats even bring their entire families, and for a few days, they're just partying in Rakada. But one night, I think it was after 3 days of banqueting, the drowsy, tipsy guests return to their chambers, and Ibrahim orders teams of his slave soldiers to sneak across the palace, going into the bedchambers and murdering the guests one by one. By dawn, Rakada would become a house of 1,000 corpses. And clearly, not actually a great place to catch some Z's.
Yeah, I'm going to leave a 1-star review on Yelp. Yeah, so this was probably the most infamous night in Tunisian history, maybe even medieval Islamic history, writ large, which permanently condemned Ibrahim to be remembered as a tyrant. But in the short term, the outrage caused by these massacres ruined his reputation among the Aghlabid nobility, as well as foreign Muslim rulers like the Sultan of Egypt and the Caliph over in Baghdad himself.
Right. So as you so often see, local nomadic rivals start trying to challenge Ibrahim. In this case, it was the Libyan Berbers from the Nafusa Mountains. But the loyalty of Ibrahim's slave army couldn't be broken no matter how cruel he was. So with this very successful army, he was able to crush these upstart nomads at the Battle of Manu. And in possibly the single most outrageous story of Ibrahim's reign, after this battle, he personally murdered 500 Libyan prisoners and ate the corpses of 15 of them.
You know, I'm starting to think that this guy might have a few screws loose.
Yeah. So these stories eventually reached all the way to Baghdad, the seat of the Sunni caliph. And this caliph decides that enough is enough. Because the Aghlabid Emirate is still in theory a vassal of the caliphate, they only held power at the behest of the caliph. So he tells Ibrahim that as a result of this wanton cruelty, he must relinquish the title of emir. And shockingly, although he's brutal and paranoid, Ibrahim is also a devout Muslim. So when the caliph tells him this, he says, sure, all right. His nephew succeeds the throne. But Ibrahim does not renounce violence, which the caliph also wanted him to. Instead, he declares himself to now be not an emir, but an independent holy warrior. He frees the thousands of his slave soldiers, he releases suspected subversives from his dungeons, and then he and his only remaining friends embark to Sicily and finally capture those last Christian holdouts we mentioned. But after, as soon as he captures these last final towns, he would die of dysentery.
Yeah, well, I guess everyone really lucked out that he decided to peace out when he did, because sounds like he could have gone around, caused a lot more trouble.
Right, yeah. No, yeah. He really had a crazy rule, because like we said, although I'm sure half of those stories are bullshit, he was definitely an exceedingly violent, exceedingly hardline ruler. But he would also bring important, I would say, benefits to Tunisia and Sicily. The intensification of agriculture would mean that there would be a lot more abundant food available, which was probably the most important thing for everyday people's lives, you know? Everyday people, they weren't the ones being killed at Rakada. They were the ones benefiting from these very sophisticated underground canals.
But unfortunately for the commoners, Ibrahim's choice to disband the slave army meant that his successors no longer had an independent power base and would again be at the mercy of the nomadic tribes and the aristocracy, which was now mostly in Sicily.
Right. We should mention that even though, in a sense, Ibrahim's rule would be the most prosperous time in Tunisian history, at least under the Aghlabids, very soon after, it would all collapse.
So just like the Nafusa Berbers, whom Ibrahim had defeated in Sicily, there was now a new group of nomads known as the Kutama, who were organizing a revolt against the Emirate. The Kutama were from the humid mountains of northern Algeria. They're most likely the ancestors of the Berber people who are now known as the Kabylia in northern Algeria. And their leader was an Arab missionary by the name of Abu Abdullah al-Shay, who was originally from Iraq.
Right. We should just add, he was an Iraqi cleric, and he claimed descent from the Prophet's daughter, Fatima. Anybody who's read much about Islamic history can already tell that Abdullah was a Shiite at a time when Islamic dynasties were overwhelmingly Sunni, and that Abdullah and his Kutama army would go on to found the famous Fatimids.
As I mentioned previously, the Berbers of North Africa, they were not really fans of many of the practices brought in by the conquering Arabs. So consequently, they did adopt Islam, but many of them adopted not the orthodox Sunni Islam of the conquerors, but rather all of these sects which would have been considered heretical. For instance, there was a sect called the Kharijiyya, who were basically these early extremists, as they're called in the Islamic historiography. But in fact, this group had been responsible for the killing of Uthman, who was the third successor of Muhammad after Umar and Abu Bakr. And so these Kharijites, they found a willing audience in North Africa.
Right, which is a bit like the Ibadis, a little bit like the Ibadis we talked about earlier, who had also found kind of some support among the Berbers.
After the death of Emir Ibrahim, Abu Abdullah and his Shiite Berber army quickly swept across Tunisia. Across the sea, the Muslim lords of Sicily made no effort to lend a hand against these encroachments. And so consequently, in just a handful of years, Abu Abdullah was able to overthrow the Aghlabids from their court in Rakalda and establish the Fatimid dynasty centered in Egypt, who were not only the emirs, but the caliphs of a new Shiite caliphate. This would be the first Shiite caliphate in Islamic history.
And so this dynasty would be very important for going on to rule Egypt and even the Near East for hundreds of years. But as a result of these ambitions in the East, they would pay a lot less attention to Sicily than the Aghlabids, and eventually even withdraw from Tunisia itself, where they'd come from. They gave a man named Hassan al-Kalbi free reign to rule Sicily on their behalf, but just like how the Aghlabids started, this governor, who founded the Kalbid dynasty, would really become a new hereditary monarch.
Again, another very funny name. Kalb is the Arabic for dog. So this is the dog dynasty, kind of, yeah?
Wow, and I don't want to stereotype here, but I understand that there's often kind of an aversion to dogs in among a lot of Muslims. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Most schools of Islamic jurisprudence consider that contact with dogs is unclean. If you come into contact with a dog, you are going to have to redo your ablutions before you can make prayer again. So it's kind of a taboo. Although, of course, many people in the countryside and pastoralists would, of course, have dogs.
And, of course, many people in the West today, or I'm sure even in Muslim countries, have dogs. Yeah, but it's this tradition. But in any case, what this shows is that someone seems to have had it out for Hassan al-Kalbi. And perhaps because of that, he would be very unsuccessful as a ruler of Sicily. And none of his descendants would have ever any success at bringing back the kind of order that had existed on the island under the Aghlabids. Sicily would stay prosperous, but low-level civil wars would be constant, and eventually various local nobles with varying levels of loyalty to the figurehead leader al-Kalbi would fight amongst themselves. And because history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme, these kinds of civil wars within Sicily eventually led to one Kalbid emir being evicted. He's kicked out of the island, and he goes to the nearest port that will take him. This time, you have a Muslim refugee going to a Christian port. And ultimately, just like with the case of Euphemius 200 years earlier, this plea for help from a foreign power will lead to the end of this period of Sicilian history, and eventually the return of Christianity, or at least Christian rulership, to the island.
So in 1038, after two centuries of Arab rule, another emperor named Michael, this time Michael the Paphlagon, would launch a sudden and massive attempt to retake the island. In this way, Islamic rule was bookmarked by two emperors named Michael. During this two-year campaign, the Byzantines and their mercenary army would capture eastern Sicily and besiege many of the cities of the Muslims before eventually being repelled. Although this Byzantine campaign would fail, the stresses of this war would lead to Sicily splitting up into four weak Muslim territories called Taifas. This was the same process that happened in Spain.
And Anatolia, too.
Yeah. And these remaining kingdoms would spend their few remaining years in constant conflict with each other, which destroyed most of the island and uprooted the prosperity which had been reintroduced to Sicily under the Aghlabids.
Right. But perhaps most significantly about this Byzantine invasion was that a lot of the soldiers in the early 11th century under Byzantine service weren't Greeks themselves. We've talked a lot before about the Varangian Guard and the fact that a lot of Slavic peoples and even Turkic peoples would work as mercenaries for the Byzantines. But starting in the 11th century, you have a new group being hired by the Greeks. This is a group that did not previously have much direct encounters with the wonders of Mediterranean civilization. But as soon as they got a taste of it, they weren't going to let it go. Just like the Arab centuries before, this was a new, expanding, adventurous cultural group. We just talked about them. They'll be the focus of our next episode. They are the Normans. And that is as far as we can go in the history of Sicily with this week's episode. But in just a few days, we'll be back with another episode on the second chapter of this really shared Arab-Norman civilization. Because what's so interesting is that when the Normans would get to Sicily, just like the Arabs before them, they wouldn't destroy the civilization they found. Instead, the Normans would create their own Mediterranean empire that would build off of the legal systems and the cultural landscape established first by the Greeks and then by the Arabs, really creating this kind of joint society. But we're talking about the Normans next week. For now, let's kind of recap the really impressive achievements of Muslim rule in Sicily.
Yeah, so as we mentioned, Sicily benefited greatly economically from all of these changes introduced in the Islamic period. At the time of the Islamic conquest, the Middle East was generally more scientifically advanced than the West, especially when it came to dry agriculture. The historian Alex Metcalf said, quote, "Western Sicily saw the transformation of an agricultural system which for over 300 years had developed into complex, diversified, intensive, and extensive systems of production that could nourish large surrounding populations and market towns, as well as export yields."
Right, and I want to note there that 300 years, which means that this kind of Arab-influenced development would continue into the Norman period. Because really, the Norman period was just the Arab period of Sicily with a new Christian, French, vaguely Viking coat of paint.
Yeah, and one of the legacies that you can still see to this day, if you're ever in the mood to go to Sicily and visit the city of Palermo, you can actually tour the canals built by the Aghlabids under the city.
That's cool, yeah. Another kind of fun lingering impact in Sicily is, as you might expect, the language and culture, you know. So before the Arab conquest, Sicily was probably entirely Greek-speaking, but the sudden arrival of these large numbers of Arab settlers, as well as, more importantly, the introduction of Arabic as a prestige language, would really influence the Greek dialect that was spoken in Sicily, which would then go on to influence the modern Sicilian language, which is very similar to Italian.
And interestingly enough, the one word of Sicilian that everybody in the world knows comes from Arabic. The word mafia likely comes from the Arabic majes, which basically means swagger.
That's awesome. Yeah. I know that a lot of, in Sicily, a lot of words that are used in everyday speak are actually from Arabic. Like, for instance, miskin, which means bad luck. That's an Arabic word.
They have the word gasira. Or Jazeera in Arabic, meaning island.
Oh, for island. Yeah, like Al Jazeera, yeah. Or Algiers.
Yeah, exactly. And to this day, Sicilian fishermen will use words like shabaka for their nets, which is an Arabic word. And leaders in the Sicilian dialect are known as ra'is.
Yeah, right. So, yeah.
But what I found most interesting and maybe most mysterious is that if you go to the Cathedral of Palermo and you look carefully at the columns, you'll find that one of them is engraved with an ayah from the Quran. This is from the 7th surah, ayah 54, which reads, "Verily, your sustainer is God, who has created the heavens and the earth in 6 eons, and is established on the throne of his almightiness. He covers the day with the night in swift pursuit, with the sun and the moon and the stars subservient to his command. Oh, verily, his is all creation and all command. Hallowed is God, the sustainer of all worlds."
Whoa, on a Christian cathedral.
Yes, the column that this is written on, it was actually a column originally used in the Roman era, but when they were building this part of the cathedral in the 15th century, for whatever reason, they kept the Quranic verse present. Nobody is sure why Christians would do that, but it's a very interesting cultural artifact.
Right. And, you know, if you do happen to visit Sicily, like we said, you could see the Qanats, but also so many place names, especially in the Southwest, are Arabic names. Probably most famously, the city Marsala, like chicken Marsala, not to be confused with chicken Masala. Marsala means God's harbor, Marsa'ala in Arabic. And then by contrast, in the north and east of Sicily, everything is Greek. Almost all the names, they might look Italian, but if you look at the origin, they're Greek words. We should probably mention here, going a little bit out of Sicily, the last holdout of the Sicilian Arabic dialect, which was once quite widespread, is actually in Malta.
Yeah, Maltese is a very interesting case. I wouldn't call it an Arabic dialect per se, because there's a lot of other stuff going on. But in terms of the grammar, at least, it resembles Tunisian Arabic very closely. Although the Maltese are almost entirely Christian today, their language and the names are permanently shaped by centuries of Muslim rule, even more than the Sicilians.
Yeah, and so, you know, for example, we talked about how, like, the most famous Sicilian word is from Arabic, mafia. Well, the most famous Maltese American, good old Pete Buttigieg, has a name that comes from Arabic, Abu Jaja, which is, you know, father of the chicken, which I assume means that his ancestors were poultry farmers. You know, also, we should probably mention here is that a friend of the pod, Candrus Ord Liberal, who you should all follow on Twitter, he posted a lot about how a few obscure colonial languages, like Papiamento and Aruba, are a remnant of much older languages that were once spoken all across Brazil and South America, but then were eventually replaced by standardized Spanish and Portuguese dialects. I think there's kind of a similar thing in Malta. There was once this shared Arabic dialect spoken all across various islands in the Mediterranean, but now only survives in tiny Malta.
Yeah, and again, it's very much a hybridized language. Something like 30% of the vocabulary comes from either English or Italian, which makes it a very interesting mix. It's also the only Arabic-derived language that's written with the Latin alphabet today.
Yeah. Just to wrap up here, the Arab conquest of Sicily would create these new links between the Islamic and Christian worlds, which had previously existed in the classical era, but had basically dissolved for about 200 years. So in a sense, you could say that thanks to this conquest, in a sense, the two halves of classical Mediterranean civilization would be reunited, at least for a time. And I think that to wrap up this episode, we can show a great example of what this kind of reunion looked like with another island that's not Sicily and it's not Malta, but instead it's Sardinia. So before the defeat at the Battle of Ostia, when Arab pirates still ruled the Mediterranean, one group of Tunisian explorers set up coastal forts in Sardinia. They had hoped to subjugate the villages in the interior and set up new agricultural estates, just like in Sicily, but it turns out that this island was even more mountainous and much less suitable for lucrative agriculture. Even worse, none of the ports in Sardinia were even worth plundering. But according to Ibn Khaldun, what the Tunisians found most intriguing about Sardinia was the Sardinians themselves. Because when the Muslim invaders heard the locals speak, they were shocked. It turns out that the Romance language of the Sardinians, which is still spoken today, sounded exactly like the now extinct Romance language of North Africa, which was still widely spoken by both Jews and Christians in the 9th century. Also interestingly, both Arabs and Sardinians had a deep interest in the stars, And the Sardinian name for the Milky Way, which was the Road of Straw, was also the same phrase used in North Africa at this time.
Although linguists today believe that the similarity is probably more to do with Roman connections that were shared by both Tunisia and the Mediterranean islands, the Arabs of Tunisia believe that this meant that the Sardinians were long-lost Africans, maybe even refugees who had escaped the Arab conquest to a more remote island.
Right. So on one hand, this meant that Sardinians were rightful Aghlabid subjects who owed them, 200 years of back taxes. But it also meant, in a more positive sense, that the Sardinians and the Tunisians were long-lost brothers, separated by language, but united by a common heritage. The Muslims would never manage to have more than a toehold in Sardinia, but I think this story kind of shows us how increased Islamic activities in the Mediterranean, particularly the conquest of Sicily, sort of led to the two halves of the Mediterranean rediscovering each other. Just like in Spain, Sicily would become a really important transit point for Middle Eastern and European goods and ideas across the Mediterranean. And, that's why I think that this is a great bridge for our next episode, which was what Sicily would look like once the Normans took over. Because while the Norman period would mark the end of Islamic rule in Sicily, I would argue that it wouldn't mark the end of Islamic civilization. Because the Normans would have a really unusual respect for their non-Christian subjects and become much bigger patrons of non-Christian art and culture than I think really any European Christians at this time would have been. In addition, though, their new connections with the Eastern Mediterranean would draw the Normans ultimately into one of the most important events in the entire High Middle Ages, the Crusades. So for next week, we're going to tell you just how these beer-swilling Frenchmen managed to go all the way from the northern shores of France down to the Mediterranean. And then in coming weeks, we're going to stay in North Africa, but go a lot farther into modern times and talk about the ways that Spanish and French colonial activity in Morocco would, in a sense, prefigure the rise of fascism in Europe.
Yeah, so stay tuned. We have a lot of exciting stuff in the pipelines, and we are really looking forward to sharing with you all that we've learned.
Yeah. If you've listened this far and you like our episodes, we really could hope that you can give us a good review, especially on Spotify. We're hoping to get those numbers up. I just saw that we now have more reviews and a better score than Chelsea Clinton's podcast. If we keep that up, I think we can even beat Bill Clinton's podcast. All right? So come on, guys. You can do it.
If we get good enough, can we have Clinton on the podcast?
Oh, God, I would love that. Yeah, let's do it. So like I said, a lot of things coming. We're going to be publishing, or at least republishing, the book The Magnet very soon, which is so exciting, and that is all thanks to Russian Sam. Thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed, and we'll be back very shortly to tell you about the next chapter in Sicilian history and what that means for the broader history of the Mediterranean at large. Thank you so much.